Welcome to the China Desk Podcast, presented by the Federal Newswire, with your host, Steve Yates.
Welcome to the China Desk Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow for China and National Security at the Heritage Foundation. A reminder to our audience, for whom we are most grateful, viewers can watch the China Desk on YouTube or subscribe to hear all our interviews on Apple, Spotify, and most other podcast providers. We welcome you to check out our website and show archive at chinadeskpodcast.com. My guest today is Brett Manley, Executive Director of the Energy Fair Trade Coalition. The EFTC is a nonpartisan, nonprofit grassroots organization dedicated to holding global energy companies accountable to U.S. labor and trade laws. It educates consumers, federal agencies, and Congress on energy industry practices which harm American competitiveness and violate the principles of fair trade. They seek to ensure objective application and enforcement of U.S. laws and promote human rights and fair trade in the energy industry. Prior to leading the Energy and Fair Trade Coalition, Brett served as a naval intelligence officer and previously worked on Capitol Hill as chief of staff to a senior member of the Congressional Climate Solutions Caucus. Brett, welcome to the China Desk. Let's jump in.
All right, Steve, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. We've got an important topic to cover, those two oft-used words of rare earths. But before we get into that cool and scientific genre, let's talk a little bit about Brett and how you came to be leading this coalition and took up an interest in this important global priority. So when you were growing up and sort of the third grade teacher said, what do you want to do when you grow up? You say, I want to work on the Hill and someday lead a fair trade and energy coalition.
No, actually, I told him I wanted to be an anchor on SportsCenter.
That was that's a good goal.
Yeah.
So, what was your journey up through education that led you to the area of public policy?
Sure. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. I was a child of the 80s and 90s. I arrived in college at the University of California, Berkeley. In 2001. 9/11, happened, what was that, third week of school or something like that, really kind of, everybody kind of, I'm 42, so my age, a little bit older, you kind of have the before after, right? Coming out of the 90s, the grunge and the punk kind of influence, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, this serious thing happened. Yeah, I grew up in a nice part of Southern California, typical suburb, played baseball, that kind of stuff. So this was like a big shock to me. And certainly, as you would expect, the reaction on campus at a place like Berkeley is as stereotypical as you would imagine it. Of course, it's pre-social media and everything. So, it's not making national news. But I was kind of just dumbfounded at the reaction of some of the folks on campus. And that spurred me to kind of get a little bit involved in politics, which was not at the time on my list of things I wanted to do. I wanted to make money. And, graduated and, the Republicans lost the House in 2006 in very dramatic fashion. Obviously, Bush was quite unpopular at the time. I remember having a conversation with my father. I was working in the Bay Area doing technology sales, as everyone does kind of around there. And, he just kind of dared me to make the plunge. So I quit my job. I bought a one-way ticket, D.C., and I had a friend who let me sleep on their couch. I didn't have a job or anything. I got an internship and, did 16 years on Capitol Hill with some time in the Naval Reserves as an intelligence officer, as you mentioned. We were a casualty of redistricting. My most immediate past boss, Rodney Davis, Illinois redistricted quite egregiously, and it cost us our seat. And, along the way, you've been in town, obviously, the Heritage Foundation. It's a small place, it's a company town. And, I developed some really good relationships over the years. Obviously now that technology, especially AI, is exploding, energy is becoming more important in terms of how are we going to power these things? How are we going to power the future of the American economy? And, some folks that I knew in this space came to me and asked me if I'd be interested in doing this. And we had a nice conversation and it lined up well with my personal beliefs. I wasn't going to go out and shill for something I didn't think was important. And here we are. And it's been fun. It's an interesting space to be in. It changes every day, as you know.
Yeah.
And so, we're just trying to, I think educate folks, because a lot of times in the energy space, you know, the supply chains are complex. The technology is complex. This is not, you know, I hate to say this to a lot of people, but, you know, the United States, when it comes to some elements of the energy space like solar, we are not the experts here. We don't own most of the IP. We're trying to catch up in a lot of ways. And, you know, just trying to educate folks on, you know, the things that we need to do to get beyond a press release or a headline into how this actually works on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Before we jump into that, let's talk a little bit about how you cultivated your interest in the energy space and then the fair trade topic. These are sort of two interesting lines intersecting with what your coalition is doing.
Yeah. So, you know, the energy space, like anything, you know, you need energy to power AI, you need energy to power technology, you need energy to drive your car. You know, I'm from California. You know, that state has kind of committed energy suicide over the last 10 to 20 years. They decommissioned all their coal plants. They were shutting down all the nuclear plants until they finally even realized that was insane and saved Diablo Canyon. I have family still out there. You know, my brother, he lives in San Diego. His electric bill is $700 a month.
Yikes.
Yeah, in a 1,500 square foot bungalow in San Diego. So, you know, I'm one of those conservatives who cares a lot about government policy and how it affects my pocketbook. And, you know, your energy bill and how you get around, the fuel you put in your car and all that stuff is a daily expense that I care a lot about. And it also intersects with a lot of geopolitical and international, you know, issues that are important to the United States of America. And I think we have a right, and we should, if we won't care about the future of our country, be, you know, heavily involved in that. And to your second point on the fair trade element, you know, I grew up kind of a traditional kind of, you know, what they used to call country club Republican. You know, free trade was, you know, the milieu of the Republican Party, right? And, you know, I remember being on the Hill during the last free trade agreement with Korea, and then, you know, Obama, of course, tried to pass TPP. And I remember my boss at the time, a guy from California, Jeff Denham, we actually had Democrats on our whip card because they were all voting no, you know, they wouldn't support it. And times have changed incredibly since then. But I think Trump really, you know, a lot of people get freaked out about a lot of things he says, but he really put, I think, forced Americans, or a lot of Americans, to grapple with the idea that if you turn your country into a service-based economy, which is what has primarily happened in the United States for the last 50 years, where we've outsourced manufacturing, if you turn it into a service-based economy, you really put yourself at risk if the supply chain becomes either convoluted to the point where you can't afford it, or, you know, controlled by someone who may have different geopolitical goals than you do. And as energy has become more important, you know, that's become more of a concern. I said this to a reporter, you know, would you outsource our food production to a foreign country? And of course, the answer would be no. But, you know, energy, you can't do anything without energy. So I kind of put energy in that same bucket as food, national defense, those types of things. And so I think making sure that America has America's interest at heart when it comes to these topics is the most important thing.
Yeah, well, it's very much in alignment with what we have talked about for this podcast. And Ambassador Bob Lighthizer is a friend to a lot of us. And he has helped sort of define where these things maybe have shifted over the years. And it is interesting being around Capitol Hill for a long time and feeling that there were opposing sides in the 90s that now have switched sides almost entirely on some of these principled issues. So interests and definitions have changed, but partly the world's changed. So one of the things that we never talked about in the 1990s was rare earths. We had the internet revolution going on, and information was going to change the world. It was going to be too fast for the authoritarians to keep up. It was like the final frontier of libertarianism around the world. But now in 2025, we're in an era where technology can and is used to control people as much as it is to liberate people, but also where trade no longer can ignore dependencies And there's, I think, an open question of whether you can have free trade with unfree systems. So I think we've got a completely different set of conversation points now. But let's pivot in, if you don't mind, into sort of definitions of how to talk about this. You know, begin at the beginning of when you get asked and see things in the news, people are talking about critical minerals, key mineral supplies. What are we talking here? Help us sort of set the table about the basic building blocks of this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, critical. I appreciate that, and I think, you know, the way I view what you're talking about there is that when it comes to trade, the biggest question, whether it's free or fair, is are the trading partners' incentives aligned? And if they're not aligned, what do we need to do to align them to enter in that fair system, whether it's a free system you're trading with or not? Rare earths, you know, they become more important, of course, right? Because the advancements in technology, you know, we're able to do things that we couldn't do before. You know, Elon's going to send a man to Mars, he says, right? And I believe him. You know, I think if you asked, you know, folks who grew up in the 60s and 70s who saw the moon landing, if you told them that, you know, 95% or 90 to 95% of all the world's rockets launched in space would be launched by a private company controlled by one person, they would tell you that the world has collapsed and everything is insane, some dystopian future. But that's where we are. And because the technology has enabled it, and the United States has a business climate that allows for that type of risk taking and encourages it. And we should embrace that. And, you know, I don't want to bore your guests and most of these or listeners with most of these words I can't pronounce properly, but rare earths are essentially things that, you know, you don't use in everyday products, right? They're specialized. They're highly customizable, but limited use case, right? They're not used to make, you know, tires, right? So because of that, they have a very specific cause and effect, and, you know, the incentives for investing in those materials are different than if you were going to say invest in something like polysilicon, which is not a rare earth mineral, but, you know, is the primary ingredient in like a solar panel or a semiconductor chip. But the other components of those materials, you know, in guiding systems or whatever it is for national defense, you are necessary to make it run. It's just not the primary thing. And so we have those things here, but because of that, there's no mass market, right, for rare earth materials. And so if you think about this economically, there's no mass market for it. You know, the profit motive, which is, I think, the core of the American financial system, and I'm very supportive of that, means that we will try to accommodate the need for these things without undue investment. And what has happened is because we are a very mineral-rich country, which has allowed us to become the most dominant nation in the world, economically and militarily, means that we have these materials, but we outsource the production or refining of those materials, right? It's not that we don't have them. We have them to some extent, but we don't have the technology or the prowess, to refine those materials, to make them usable into the system. So we outsource that. And in large part, we outsource it, you know, to China, who has invested heavily, you know, in these processes. Of course, there are a lot of differences between the countries. And I don't want to get into too much stuff because, you know, the Chinese people are good people, right? But we're never going to be able to compete with them on labor costs, you know, for a variety of reasons, right, that we can get into or not get into. In the same way that we're not going to compete with Canadians or Europeans or whatever on certain things, the United States is a very wealthy country. We have extremely high standard of living, something we should be very proud of. And for a variety of reasons, you know, AI manufacturing is a new thing. It hasn't been here. You know, this is year really that it's become more possible. So you needed the human labor element, and the profit motive just incentivized companies to outsource the production of that. And that production was outsourced primarily to China, which is how we found ourselves in this position. And then, of course, I don't think it probably would be an issue in everybody's mind if the president hadn't made it a priority of his to enforce or to engage in more aggressive trade normalization with certain countries. I think China probably would be more than happy to continue to maintain this dominance in this area and you know, keep doing this as long as nobody noticed. But we, you know, here we are. The president feels very strongly about the tariff imbalances that he feels exist. And, you know, it makes perfect logical sense, you know, that President Xi would use this as a leverage point. I would if I were him. You know, so that's kind of where we find ourselves in asking, you know, what do we do about it now?
Well, can we talk a little bit about the supply and market parts of this? Because there's a lot floating around in news and politics, and it's kind of hard for casual consumers of this information to sort out what's fact, what's assumption, what might not even be right. But you stated what I have learned and believe, that we actually have pretty ample supply of a lot of these things, but there are reasons why we haven't either harvested or processed them ourselves. That's one part of the sort of market economics of this. Maybe the regulatory state is another reason for that. But the other thing that has come up is that we have become so dependent on China for this that we actually have a critical vulnerability that may be influencing policymakers to think that they need to be maybe a lighter touch on negotiations with China, because if they chose to exercise this leverage, it could be crippling for us in the short term. So that's kind of a huge, huge topic. But let's begin with sort of the supply demand and of it. Do we really have enough of a supply ourselves? And what would it take, absent China's influence, for us to be better stewards of what we already have?
Yeah, I mean, the supply question is hard to answer because, you know, you'd have to really capitalize, you know, we have explored our oil reserves. We have explored, you know, those are known quantities. You know, it's like Donald Rumsfeld used to say, we don't, you know, the known unknowns. You know, because we have not prioritized this as a part of our economy, we haven't really invested the resources and the time into finding out, you know, just how much we have here. And then the second element of that is the technology has changed so fast, so rapidly, that it's like, what does this look like 10, 20, 30 years from now? What is the demand, the downstream demand? Because 30 years prior, you know, when we were growing up, we didn't have this demand. So, you know, and then certainly if something were to happen, the world were to go to war, that demand spikes. You know, if we have times of peace, it comes down. So I think about it in terms, and I like to try to simplify this when talking to folks who don't follow this space. You know, if you think about World War II, the United States, I don't believe, and a lot of people might get mad at this, we didn't necessarily win the war because we had the best military strategy in the world. There's a lot of people who might agree with that. But we could replace our tanks and airplanes faster than anybody else could, yeah. Right? We could sustain the losses because of our manufacturing might. And we had superior processes in place. We had superior economy in place. We had better access to resources, more energy than our adversaries did. And we could put those back on the field of play faster than our opponents could, which gave us an immeasurable advantage in warfare. If you were to enter into a similar situation now, and I'm not saying we're going to be at war with the Chinese or some other entity, but if you were, that would be a significant factor because of the advanced weapon systems we have today that use these materials. We don't have that process. There would be a lag time to develop it, you know, some amount of time to develop the prowess. And so I put this back to a difference in political systems. Mainly you mentioned, you know, have people known about this, but because of it have been a lighter touch. You know, United States, you know, our election cycle is two and 4 years, right? And so politicians, because of that, are very hesitant to take risks, right? It encourages a risk-averse approach to policymaking. It encourages a status quo approach to policymaking. And, you know, not every country in the world, most countries in the world don't have that, you know, stressor. And so as a result, the Chinese, for instance, are very good at thinking and planning 10, 20, 30 years in advance. They have the luxury of doing that. Their political leadership has the luxury of doing that. And I think that's largely been absent in the United States when it comes to these types of issues, is what is this going to look like 20 years from now? Because if there's a short-term pain involved in that, the incentive for that politician to avoid that decision is a no-brainer, right? If your interest is in just getting reelected. But Trump's in a great position because he doesn't have to get reelected. He's termed out. You know, he's been talking about these types of things his whole life. So he obviously believes these. These are core beliefs of his. And I think really when you look forward, future presidents, as much as some of them might complain about it now, will thank him for being this aggressive at this point.
Yeah. So I take away from that is that we do have a lot that we can exploit, use. I sort of am a firm believer that the Creator gave us an endowment. It's our job to use it responsibly. There's no good economic reason for us long term to be extracting resources here or elsewhere and having it make two trips across the Pacific to get processed and back into our supply chains. And so we've sort of sleepwalked into this flow of supply chains and overdependence in one area, and now have a strategic vulnerability that's economic vulnerability, but also potential time of conflict vulnerability that has to get addressed. But people are afraid of the cost and the time that would be required to make the adjustment. Historically, those adjustments happen when people are left with no further choice. It's a Pearl Harbor 9/11 kind of thing where change comes because all avenues for procrastination or diversion have been exhausted. Right. Hopefully it doesn't come to that, but we're at least at the front end of a conversation of how to start going down that road. Another part of this, though, is sort of the fair trade part of it, but maybe starting on the dependency area. You've warned that China could weaponize minerals like polysilicon and beryllium against the United States. You know, what would that actually look like in practice? How quickly could it impact our energy infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think to your point, we tend to only pay attention when it's an emergency, right? And it's we have no other choice. You know, for Americans of my generation, it's very difficult to envision a world at war, right? Where the entire country is engaged in the machinery of, you know, physical warfare, right? And I think a lot of people assume that that will never happen again. I think that's a naive view of human nature and just conflict generally. You know, the borders that you see in the world now will likely change and continue to change ad infinitum. Long after we're gone from here and our great, great grandkids are running around trying to figure it out. You know, there are levels to it, right? Certainly, I think, if you look at the geopolitical issues, you see an emergence of Russia, or at least their desired emergence as a global power again, in China, and, you know, establishing itself and has a long-term project of theirs for 30, 40 years. You see this kind of collision coming, right, between the three, you know, what you would call superpowers, certainly with the decline of Europe economically, which, you know, Trump talks about all the time. And Africa has not yet emerged. And, you know, the South American BRIC economies, you know, just haven't gotten there, right? And so you really have China, Russia, United States as like the global players. And the way I view this is the three of us are jockeying for position on who is going to have influence in the global economy and how conflict will play out in the future. It's interesting because I don't see, and this is just a personal theory of mine, I feel like a lot of the actions we see coming out of China are related a little bit to their population issues in the wake of the one-child policy. A lot of people who study this, and it's not my field of expertise, you know, are making pretty strong claims that the population of China will decline to the point where they're going to have serious issues. If you believe that to be true, and as a policymaker, certainly you would want to press your advantage in certain areas now. And I think you see that with their military buildup, with their expansion in coal and energy production. Really pressing their advantage that they have now. So it makes sense to me from that standpoint. At the end of the day, we're still separated by the Pacific Ocean, which is probably the biggest military advantage we have, and the Atlantic Ocean on the other side. We're very far away, you know, from folks. And so I'm not a catastrophist where I think, you know, if there were conflict, this would be an immediate thing. If it came to that, then the conflict is so serious that, you know, we're really talking about a different day-to-day life for everybody, you know, globally. But it certainly is a leverage point to your point, because there isn't anybody else we can turn to. And so a lot of what we talk to is like, okay, well, even if you don't have it here in the United States, even if we don't have that, we need to look for our allies who are aligned with us and partner with them on these issues. You know, the Europeans have some of this stuff, as I mentioned. You know, there are you know, minerals certainly in the African continent. Australia is a very mineral-rich nation. You know, are there ways where we can partner together and try to align our supply chains with those countries where if something were to happen to compromise our supply chain out of Asia, that we had somewhere to turn and we weren't so reliant on one single place? And that's another element of it, right? And how do you reward that? Our view is that you should reward from a policy perspective, vertical integration. And if you can't vertically integrate totally, at least integrate with allies into your supply chain. And as policymakers, and I'm very critical of the IRA that President Biden signed into law, you know, our view is that it was designed to maximize end-stage production and get things online as fast as possible, culminating in a re-election campaign. It's my personal view on that. But so what happens, right? If you maximize tax incentives for end-stage production, you're incentivizing lowering input costs to the greatest extent possible, which means you import goods from abroad. And in the case of energy production and this, you know, these tax credits, that came from Asia. And so you incentivize these companies to put projects online as quickly as possible using the cheapest inputs they can find, which came from Asia. That is at the expense of companies who vertically integrate and try to manufacture here domestically. If you incentivize the upstream component element of a lot of these energy products, you incentivize investment in these material processing, in the material development, in the mining of these materials, which we haven't done because it's not sexy. It doesn't give you big headlines on Wall Street. These aren't companies you ever heard of that are going to make a splashy investment. But because we haven't done that, the tax incentives weren't designed to incentivize those things. You haven't seen it happen as quickly, I think, as we'd like.
I think that vertical integration part is very, very important. Can you talk a little bit about some of the trade issues that have come up? There are Section 232 investigations. What do people need to understand about when they hear these numbered sort of U.S. trade law kind of processes? They probably have no clue what that really means. Sort of going about their everyday life, worried about, do we have a vulnerability or no, a shortage or no, or price is going to go up or down? But what's on the horizon with regard to that part of things? They've heard of the trade war, so-called, and rebalancing and tariffs, but what's 232, and specifically with regard to rare earths?
Yeah, so Section 232 in its companion part 301 are the ones people hear about the most. The short story of it for the uninitiated is it allows the president, if he or she, should the case be, decides that there is a national security issue or emergency situation that they can impose tariffs without congressional input. There are two laws that establish this quite directly. Congress passed it. They willingly gave this authority to the executive. If they didn't want to do that, they should take it back. That's a conversation for another day. But the president, you know, as I said, you know, you can find interviews of him in the 80s having this conversation with Larry Kudlow. Late night guy, I can't remember, older guy. He believes this is a national
a lot.
Yeah, Larry King, there you go. that this is a national security issue. You know, he thinks that the Americans or America made a mistake by exporting manufacturing capacity abroad. And he feels, unlike previous presidents, I think he uses the tariff issue to resolve non-tariff issues, right? So it may not necessarily and probably isn't about the actual tariffed product. He is trying to achieve some other goal. You know, you saw, I think last week, the tariffs on India were really about him wanting them to stop buying Russian oil. We can't force them to stop buying Russian oil, but he knows that if he, you know, he can provide leverage with them on tariffs for that point. So I think you're going to see this continue for the next 3 years. What'll be interesting, you know, from our standpoint is does the future, whether it's a J.D. Vance or a Marco Rubio or a Democrat, were to win the next presidency, are they going to continue this practice, right? If they see, you obviously see that this works to some extent. So are they going to continue that? So I think, you know, on the rare earth front, the president has said this is a national security issue. So he's going to tariff these programs. And what we would like to see in addition, right, because it's, you can't, I don't think, we don't view that you can just get there through tariffs, right? You know, the supply chain, I liken it, it's like water, right? If your house is leaking and you plug it, the water just goes somewhere else and it leaks somewhere else. You know, so what you see is you may tariff something from China, and so they'll move it to Vietnam or Malaysia or Korea, and then it enters the United States through that, you know, trade point. And so now you're just paying for it twice, because you're paying for the tariff to go there, and then you're paying for the upcharge for the guy on the way by who distributed to you, the arbitrage. So without that second component of incentivizing domestic investment, it's just a band-aid, right? That and it's not going to cover the whole wound. So we'd really like to see some tax incentives. And you saw it a little bit as a conservative. I'm not in love with this approach, the government taking a stake in the mine, in the critical mineral mine in California. I think we should leave the private sector to the private sector and not engage in government ownership of these things. But, you know, you never know what the next government's going to do. So that should be a private enterprise. But certainly incentivizing the investment. The president has a lot of tools. If he's going to invoke 232, you know, the Defense Production Act certainly would be a nice complement to that, and would validate the idea that it's an emergency. The Defense Production Act, for those who are unfamiliar with it, World War II is what they used it during then. It allows you to speed approvals, speed permits, you know, do things faster than you got to, you know, cuts approval time down significantly, right? We talk a lot about permitting and how long it takes the government to regulate everything. Invoking the Defense Production Act would speed that along, you know, significantly. Because ultimately, time is money. You know, the longer capital sits on the sidelines, the more opportunity cost is lost to other investments. And so I think in addition to the 232s, the president should really think about how do we incentivize financially through tax incentives, domestic production, and can we speed up the projects by invoking the Defense Production Act?
Well, I've mentioned defense and emergency a couple of times as sort of some of the buzzwords that come through as the legal authorities for doing some of these things. We'll talk for a minute about what the vulnerabilities are potentially in our military systems.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a weapons expert. So I don't, you know, take it with a grain of salt here. But, you know, a lot of our, guided missile capacity and capabilities are governed with a complex set of materials that require access to rare earth minerals. And these are systems that cannot be reproduced. I mean, you can reproduce them rapidly, but you expend them very quickly. I'm not going to compare the United States to Iran, of course, but Iran, you saw this happen in their short conflict with Israel. They ran out of missiles very quickly. You know, if you're firing 100, 200, 300, 400 a day, again, we have the advantage here of being separated by two very large oceans from anybody wishing to do us harm. But as you saw in the Cuban Missile Crisis, it wouldn't be out of the question for someone to gain access to a nearby location. And so being able to reproduce those materials, you know, is very important. Another anecdote, you know, you mentioned in the teaser, I was in the Navy as an intelligence officer. I was attached to a unit with the Air Force about, you know, we were very focused on space warfare. I think the president got a lot of grief for that in his first term, but certainly the militarization of satellites in space is an issue that military leaders are concerned about. Materials and critical minerals that go into our satellites are not easily replicated. Certainly space launch is difficult. You know, if you were to target a GPS system in space, you could knock out a significant military capability of the United States relatively quickly. It'd be very difficult to replace that in a speedy fashion. Certainly we could replace it, but I mean, when you're talking days, critical days or critical weeks, it would be very difficult to do that. And so I think it's important to remember, and I think appreciate, the one thing I appreciate the most, I think, about the president is dealing with the world as it is, not as we wish it would be. And if you deal with the world as it is, then that leads you to the right decision, right? Most of the time. We should still strive to arrive at a world we would like it to be, right? But that doesn't mean we can wish away the problems that exist now. And certainly from a military standpoint, you know, setting aside all the procurement issues, like let's assume we fix the procurement issues. And I know Heritage talks a lot about this from the military standpoint. Your whole military department talks a lot about the procurement problems. Let's say we resolved all that. You still need the inputs to procure the system, right? And so if you don't have an accurate accounting of the inputs you have, then you have a vulnerability, whether it's steel, rare earth minerals, fuel, whatever.
Let's talk for a minute about what some of these minerals are. I mean, I think copper, tellurium are ones that come up a lot. But what besides those might be others that are a particular concern for the United States in terms of dependency on China?
Yeah, I mean, they have, again, it's more of a processing than mining. And so I don't want to focus too much on like the names of these things or where they come from on the periodic table, promethium or whatever. Sometimes the deposits are economically challenging to extract because it's like the machinery needed for it is very specialized. And so, you know, it's not something you're going to build a dedicated version of. It's not something you're repurposing from somewhere else. But they come from, you know, there's primarily it's like 15 to 17 minerals we're talking about. It's not like an unlimited number of things. They go into, you know, electronics, renewable energy, of course, and high tech, anything high tech. Yttrium is one, scandium are one of them. There's 15, I want to call them lanthanides, I think is the word that you use for that. So these aren't household product names that we're talking about. But I do want to emphasize again that we're talking about specialized processes, which we don't have because we've exported that capability. You know, we don't own the IP for how to extract them. A lot of these minerals are byproducts, right? You mentioned tellurium. That's a byproduct of copper mining. Right? It's not something that you would ever manufacture on its own. It was something we discovered from mining copper. We get a lot of tellurium from Russia, incidentally. So, you know, it's another vulnerability there. Obviously, you know, when you talk about nuclear fuels, this isn't a rare earth, but like enriched uranium, you know, we used to get most of that from the Russians. And if we're going to spin up our nuclear capabilities here in the United States, we need to be mindful of where we're going to get their enriched uranium from. Because we obviously don't want to get it from the Russians anymore. You know, Biden signed, you know, an import ban on that when he was president. A lot of people celebrated that, you know, that has to come from somewhere. And so these are issues that, you know, I like to say, it's like, you can't govern by press release. You send a press release congratulating yourself for being great on the environment or great on whatever, that's fine. But what does this do for the future of the country? And, you know, again, if you outsource the capabilities, you outsource the technology, you outsource the IP, you atrophy your ability to do this. The one thing that I think we should be proud of as a country is we've arrived at this point because we have ingenuity, we have entrepreneurship, we have people who can innovate, and we have, and you have seen that through everything, you know, air flight, automobile, the internet, the telephone. These are things that would not be possible in their current forms without American ingenuity. And that's largely because of the people we have here in the ethos, and I think what it means to be an American and to be entrepreneurial. And if you start outsourcing those things to other countries, they are going to acquire those capabilities at our expense.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about two things that I think are related as we sort of move towards summing things up. We talked earlier about some of our allies, but also talked about the importance of ramping things, scaling things up here in the United States, maybe in combination What do you think is feasible, and how long do you think it would take for the United States to truly scale up where it needs to on domestic production? And are there particular trusted allies that you think could punch a bit above, more above their weight in this process too, as we safe shore but don't completely onshore?
Yeah. So, I mean, assuming nothing changes from a regulatory standpoint. I mean, it'll take anywhere from 3 to 5 years to get a mine online. That's if you don't change any regulation, you don't change any, you know, approval process, you don't change any investment incentive. I think that's going to change. The president's issued some executive orders to that effect. And they took a stake in the mineral mine in California. That's the only one that's even close to being online. So you're really looking in the short term. The next 3 to 5 years are going to be rough in terms of our ability to produce domestically at any kind of scale without significant change or incentive, which would only come from an emergency level event, which we all hope, of course, we don't find ourselves in that situation. So long term, 5 to 10, this is really a 5 to 10 year project, probably 10 year project to get us into a good glide path, but you have to set the foundation of these things. You know, money, like anything, as you know, in a free market, likes investment security. They like certainty. And so another reason the 232 and 301 tariff actions, in our view, are not sufficient, because they don't provide that regulatory certainty. They don't provide the investment security for, these are hundreds of millions of dollars investments, right? And they want to know that system that is in place is going to be there, 10 years from now, right? When the loan notes do. In terms of allies, Germany, is a NATO ally that has a lot of these technology processes and expertise. They've had their own issues with energy production and mistakes that they've made and may or may not be learning of, but they're an ally that can assist here. Australia is a big mineral production country, but they're making a lot of the mistakes, right? You see it every day where they go out and say, well, we're not going to do this anymore, we're not going to do that anymore because of the environment. But at the end of the day, it's just such a small portion of the global output that it's committing economic suicide. A lot of people are looking at Iceland as a potential, just because of the weather, you avoid a lot of need on the data front for AI and stuff, the cooling, all the cooling that's needed for a lot of this stuff. And certainly they're a very rich mineral resource. But I go back to, flashpoint at the early part of the Trump administration, which was the idea that he was going to invade Greenland. Yeah. I always viewed that much more as like Greenland, what would be bad is if somehow, the Russians were able to get in there, or the Chinese or something, probably more likely the Russians just through the Arctic Circle. But that's a mineral-rich continent. There's almost nobody really that lives there at all. And having access to those resources and whether we could work out a deal with the Danish government could be a very interesting prospect, right? You're not dealing with homes that have to be torn down or highways that have to be diverted or any of that kind of stuff. You almost have a blank slate that you could develop. And so I think those areas are important. There's some South American plays you got to deal with. Unstable governments, though, when you go down there, I mean, that's the challenge, right? I mean, a lot of people in this country, they love to complain about it, but they don't realize how good we have it here in terms of stability and just long-term, stable political environment.
Yeah, and the Chinese have no hindrance in terms of what environment they're willing to go into, whether it involves corrupt practices or displacing workers and heritage sites or whatever else. They're not going to be cowed in plowing forward on these things, Latin America or elsewhere. And we do have it pretty well. So in the sort of wrap-up area, maybe talk a little bit about the recent press release your coalition put out and what you see as kind of the near-term policy priority for your coalition. And as you do that, share any parting thoughts you have about how to tie up the message you want to convey to the audience and where they can follow your work.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I mean, we had talked about the 232 investigation, and after we filed comments, the Department of Energy issued what's called a notice of funding opportunity for rare earth and critical mineral the production. We think that's a great first step. I think the Congress, you know, the Trump can do some things, but I think the Congress really needs to come in behind that and address permitting reform to allow these projects to get online faster. You know, I was on the Hill for 16 years. It's kind of, you know, permitting reform is kind of a running joke, right? We're going to do this. This time we're going to do it. You know, but it never gets done, right? And I think a lot of times, you know, I think now the left, you know, and the green advocacy groups have kind of realized that this is impeding their ability to put green projects online. And so there may be a deal here somewhere, right, where somebody's got to swallow something they don't want to swallow. But ultimately, capital is going to go to value. And so if you reduce the regulatory burden, I really think that that's going to unleash a lot of private investment to supplement the DOE notices. And I think the president in the interim while Congress works that out can provide a roadmap by invoking the Defense Production Act. And by doing that, you're going to see, I think, a lot of interest from companies who want to secure their supply chains domestically, or at least have greater control over their input in a vertically integrated system. And you'll see that money flow, right? In a lot of the same ways, you know, Elon Musk structured SpaceX, where he's somewhat vertically integrated. He has control over that supply chain. It allows him to do things quickly, innovate quickly. It wouldn't be possible. That's why he can undercut, you know, NASA on a space flight, because he's vertically integrated. He doesn't have all these cost plus contracts going everything up. And so I think those three things, right, the investment from the federal government, you know, speeding up permitting and reviewing, which is NEPA reform, really, and then invoking the Defense Production Act, I think are the big three things. Finally, I'll say, you know, you have to enforce the law. You know, there's a law in the books, the Uyghur Forced Labor Protection Act, that says you can't import products from the Uyghur region of China. Of course, if you're a company in China, you are legally prohibited from complying with that law, because it targets the Chinese economy. And so it becomes a very opaque situation. We've met with the administration on this to say, hey, you have to just be a little bit more aggressive to deter this. We've tried to promote the idea of supply chain transparency. We understand it can be tricky, right? Because you have business process, you know, confidential information. We don't want to compromise anybody's business process that makes them competitive. But, you know, if you don't have an idea, you know, the idea is, okay, if you want to do business with the federal government in the United States, we think this is reasonable. If you're going to do business with the federal government in the United States, which a lot of these companies do, you know, that's tax dollars. Those are taxpayer dollars, and taxpayers have a right to know if you're complying with the law. And so they should, you know, there's a questionnaire that DHS puts out. You know, they should post that publicly. The people should have a right to see it, and they can see, okay, which of these people, where is this stuff coming from? And that way the government can enforce that law a little bit better, because at the end of the day, when it comes to forced labor, detaining it is great. But one at the point of detention, the forced labor has already happened, right? That product was already made. The labor already existed. And then they can just dump it in South America or somewhere else that they don't care. So without transparency, you really don't know before the product is made if there's an issue. And I mean, these are global conglomerates. You know, it's reported recently, Hanwha Qcells, which in addition to being a big solar producer, owns the Philly shipyard. They're very ingrained in the United States. They're a preferred energy supplier of the federal government. You know, they were detained in California by CBP for ties to forced labor. And so it's a serious problem. I'm pleased to see the administration taking a more forceful enforcement approach after the Biden years. But you really do have to enforce it.
So, where's the best place for people to follow you, your commentary, and the work of your coalition?
Yeah, I mean, we're at EFTC.org. We don't have the most vibrant website in the world, but, you know, I try to post my media and stuff up there when we get a chance. And then, you know, you can get me at Brett Manley, at Brett Manley on Twitter, BRETMANLEY. And anywhere you can contact me either way, and happy to engage in a conversation. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk with you. Appreciate the work you and the Heritage Foundation does. I've been familiar with your work ever since I was a young snap. The Heritage's work since I was a young staffer on the Hill. So I appreciate everything that you do.
Well, we appreciate that too. To our audience, if you have enjoyed today's China Desk conversation, please tell your friends, consider subscribing, and give a visit to chinadeskpodcast.com. Thank you for joining, and a special thank you to Brett Manley for sharing his perspectives. Until next time, I'm Steve Yates, your host here at the China Desk.
Thank you for listening to the China Desk podcast, presented by the Federal Newswire and hosted by Steve Yates. Check out the Federal Newswire's family of websites, as well as their social media streams.